Listen to the celebrations outside the Supreme Court today, concluding its current term with a decision in a case with potentially wide religious repercussions, and a case that shows deep political and gender divisions within the current Roberts Court. You can hear those loud voices of the Hobby Lobby victors there on the steps of the Supreme Court. Also later this hour, another split decision from the court removes a labor union mandate that personal home care workers on state payrolls must pay union dues if they are unionized. The ruling is a blow to the sacred closed shop principle that compels all workers who receive benefits that are negotiated by union contracts, regardless of whether they are members. We'll start, though, with the 5-4 decision that allows some privately held companies to opt out of a federal mandate to offer health insurance that includes certain kinds of birth control. In this case, two Christian-owned companies, Hobby Lobby and Conestoga Wood Specialties, which makes wood cabinets, challenged Obamacare provisions compelling them to get certain contraceptive benefits for their employees. Joining us now is Sarah Beringer Gordon, professor of law and history at the University of Pennsylvania, and in Washington, the Takeaway's Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd and Sarah, welcome to the Takeaway.
Thank you.
So how narrow would you say this case is, Professor Gordon, and how much of a can of worms does it really open in terms of me knowing my employer's religious beliefs and how I'm supposed to behave now?
That's a great question. Actually, Justice Kennedy wrote a separate concurrence just to emphasize that this case was not as sweeping as the dissent claimed, to narrow some of the language in the majority opinion. What he emphasized, and is the case for both employers, is that they were closely held corporations, meaning that their shares aren't traded on stock exchanges. They are owned by small groups of people, in both cases, families.
So a family-owned startup in Silicon Valley, which is run by atheists, can actually fire its employees if it's found out that they go to church under this decision. I mean, something like that is conceivable, right, Professor Gordon?
Well, this case is only about exemptions from some federal requirements that employers are supposed to provide to employees, not a license to mistreat them. On the other hand, this case, as Justice Ginsburg's dissent argues strenuously, is about women's bodies. And the rights of employees are not really center stage in the ways that they could have been.
And the three women on the court, of course, voted against this decision, which is an important historical fact here, right, Sarah?
You noticed, yes, indeed, there are lots of politics here, not only about religion, but also about gender and about the fact that women have traditionally paid more for health care than men have.
All right. And I know Todd's jumping up and down because there are a lot of politics here, and you could hear it in the sounds of that screaming on the steps of the U.S. Supreme Court. But one more question to you. This is not explicitly a constitutional question. It's based on a law from about 20 years ago that was all about protecting religious principles in a sort of vague way. Can you describe that law and its connection, if any, to the Constitution?
I would be happy to. The case that triggered the enactment of the law is one that involved unemployment insurance for two Native American plaintiffs. And in a majority opinion, Justice Scalia held that otherwise neutrally drafted laws do not trigger rights for free exercise exemptions. And Congress was outraged by that. They may not love all free exercise plaintiffs, but they certainly want the free exercise to be broadly interpreted, and drafted the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which the court struck down as applied to the states, but which survives as applied to the federal government. It's that statute that the court was interpreting today, and that Justice Alito, for the majority, applied to the decision and held that the statute provided stronger protections than, for example, the Federal Free Exercise Clause does.
So I guess it's not really a trivia question to the Native Americans involved, but do you remember the religious practice that was upheld by Justice Scalia back then, 20 years ago?
Yes. And in other words, it was actually struck down. It was two counselors at a substance abuse clinic had become members of the Native American Church, which uses peyote.
Peyote,
as
right. I thought that this is what I thought was the case.
Yeah.
So this stems from eating peyote by Native American tribes out west. I mean, irony of ironies. All right, so Todd Zwillick, the screaming outside the Supreme Court is going to be echoed in certain reactions on Capitol Hill. Can you describe them for us?
Yeah, without a doubt. And that screaming that you heard at the top of the segment probably hasn't been replicated since the original ruling on the individual mandate last summer that sent a lot of conservatives back to their corners to find out how to get a win on Obamacare. Well, they got one today. I do want to point out, however, even though this ruling does have pretty broad political implications for the positioning of both parties, especially on social issues, doesn't affect Obamacare all that much. My understanding is that this is a very narrow ruling that applies to one little corner of Obamacare, does not really cover the big issues like the individual mandate, the employer mandate, Medicaid subsidies, all still standing. So in terms of policy, pretty narrow. Now, we got some clues today, John, about where this might be going in terms of the politics. Both sides crafting their statements to show you that they're still running on this. Let me read you a little bit from Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader who's in a re-election fight himself in Kentucky. Today's Supreme Court decision makes it clear that the Obama administration cannot trample on the religious freedoms that Americans hold dear. Now, Republicans have been sending out lots and lots of fundraising letters, and we call them small dollar fundraising, to sympathetic voters to try to get money to protect their religious freedom from the encroachments of the Obama administration, and this ruling today helps that cause. On the other side, women's groups, Democratic groups, also within minutes had their fundraising emails go out. Your email box kind of floods with them, saying that they need to react and that all GOP candidates, particularly for the Senate, one fundraising email saying pretty much every GOP candidate supports the kinds of encroachments on women's rights that we saw from the court today. More importantly, let's talk actual responses. They're being kind of coy on the result, but John, a senior Democratic aide in the Senate told me before we came on the air that the Senate Democrats would have a legislative response to this ruling. Not saying what it is, but there have been other hints from other senators. One of the ideas that Democratic activist groups have been tossing up on the Hill is to try to pass a bill that says, hey, if you're a worker at Hobby Lobby or a similarly positioned, closely held corporation, and your employer will no longer pay for contraceptive coverage, we'll have a direct federal subsidy under Obamacare.
So they'll create
government.
They'll create a subsidy to increase the eligibility so that the exclusion by the employers doesn't have any net effect on the workers. Okay, so it sounds like for the left, the implications are fundraising for 2014. For the right, possibly new challenges on Obamacare, but you say they're really running out of those on this sort of religious issue. And in terms of legislation, there may be a subsidy option here. Does that pretty much characterize it?
That does, except there's one last point. The vote on that subsidy option, if indeed that is the legislative route that they go, let's all be honest about what that would be. A messaging vote to get senators on one side or the other with a vote. The Senate would never get 60 votes to pass that because Republicans wouldn't sign on to overcome a filibuster. And you and I both know what happens when a bill like that goes to the House. It falls flat on its face in an election year. So that would be a messaging vote, but it would serve Harry Reid and his Democrats to cast a vote, not only one way or the other on Obamacare, but on this issue as they cast it, as women's liberty to get the contraception that they have a right to. Republicans can cast their vote, too, on religious freedom.
All right. So maybe, Sarah Baringer Gordon, we should be less concerned than meets the eye about this, in the sense of we can be appalled about, you know, singling out women's bodies as an issue for, employment rules of one kind or another. But this obscure law, judged and interpreted fairly narrowly here, does not necessarily raise a huge constitutional principle that's going to cause a lot of new thinking here. Am I mistaken?
Well, this is one of a number of very hard-fought cases this year about religion that involve RFRA in this case and the Constitution in another. Public prayer was that issue. I guess I would like us to take away both that religion remains divisive politically and legally, and that the rights of employees are still not certain after this. And as Todd put it very well, the legislation will be a message rather than a policy.
Well, two very important points. Sarah Beringer-Gordon, professor of law and history at the University of Pennsylvania, and Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks to both of you.
You got it, John.
Thank you.
Another 5-4 decision. It's Harris versus Quinn. It allows some public employees to opt out of paying union fees or dues. The lead plaintiff in this case was Pam Harris, a woman from Illinois who cares for her son at home and was considered a home care worker under collective bargaining rules within the state of Illinois. Harris argued that the automatic deduction from her salary of a fee to pay union dues violated her First Amendment rights. The Supreme Court agreed. Here to discuss the implications of that case is Benjamin Ian Sachs, a Harvard Law School professor. Welcome, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, how narrow is this case because she's a home care worker and technically paid by the state, but not actually showing up on state facilities?
Right. That's the important question. What the Supreme Court has said is that with respect to this group of workers, home care workers, the state can't require everybody to pay what the union calls a fair share of their representation fee. So the union has to represent all the home care workers, but now the Supreme Court has said that home care workers can't be required to pay their share of that representation. But the court did not do what a lot of people were afraid the court would do, and that is hold that such fair share agreements are unconstitutional everywhere in the public sector. That is to say, the opinion is limited to home care workers and similar groups of employees, which might include child care workers, but doesn't apply to the huge majority of public sector workers who currently are in unions.
Well, let's explore how limited it might be. I'm assuming this Pam Harris, has for her son, cared for her son. At some point, she was able to be paid for caring for her son, right?
That's correct.
And the wages that the state paid for her caring for her son were part of the collective bargaining agreement that the Service Employees International Union, SEIU, negotiated, right?
That's correct. The critical distinction here, is that a lot of the control over the home care workers' work was exercised by the person who was receiving the care. That's, of course, how we'd want it to be. If you have a home care worker in your home, you want to be able to control a lot of the aspects of the work relationship. The state also controlled a lot of the aspects of the work relationship, and that's why in all the litigation prior to the Supreme Court, what the courts had said is both the state and the customer, the patient, were both employers. What the Supreme Court said today is that's not good enough to apply our precedent regarding fair share agreements. It's only when the state has more control or a greater degree of control, we don't know, we'll see down the future exactly where the line is drawn, but it's only when the state has more control, more authority over the employment relationship that the fair share stuff is allowable. So when you have joint control by the patient or the client, or the customer and the state, then you've got a question after Harris versus Quinn about whether fair share agreements are permissible.
All right, so here's a riddle then. Here's a legal riddle, and put on your Harvard hat if you can. If the state of Illinois decides, oh, great, so Pam Harris isn't paying union dues, we can pay her whatever we want, and lowers her wages, does that strengthen the Service Employees International Union's argument, or does it weaken the argument?
Well, you know, so Justice Kagan wrote a dissent here for four justices. She made a similar point. And what Justice Kagan said is, look, everybody would want a program in which the customer, the client, the patient has control. But what the court is saying today is the only way a state can set up a system like the one it had in Illinois is if the state assumes complete control. And nobody wants that.
Benjamin Ian Sachs of Harvard Law School, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.